Okay, let's get going. Welcome. Everybody enjoy the motion and gate lab last Thursday? Yeah, it was good. I have some pictures if you want to view that. So a few items. I've handed back all the midterm reports. If anybody has any questions about them, please. If you can't read my notes, please let me know. They were all very good. All of them could use improvement, so nobody's perfect. So I want you to take the corrections, you know, to heart for your final report. And certainly you can include a lot of the stuff in the midterm report into the final report. And you can use as much as you want because there's no limit on how long the report can be. One thing I should mention, I sort of like to have the images included in the body of the text. I know there are some people who put all the images in the back as an appendix, but I like to have them as a part of the text. It just makes it easier to read through it if people can see all the images as they read. Another thing to note is that the report is not just for me, it's for everybody, and I like to have it be a scientific report. So, you know, that involves maybe the use of third person and scientific terms rather than colloquial terms. So keep that in mind for your final report. There are two sign-up lists in front here on the yellow pages, one for Will Garage in Menlo Park on Thursday. And that ought to be awesome because the robot is going to be doing the tour. So you don't want to miss that. And next Tuesday at this time, we have a tour of the VA in Palo Alto. We'll be going to the spinal cord injury service as well as the assistive technology lab there. And so you'll be able to see clinical things, people working with real patients. We'll be there late enough so we won't be interfering with any therapy or seeing any patients, I don't think. So that's fine. Now, on both dates, Elaine's car will return to campus early for people who need to get back. And there's Elaine in the back. Sign up for her car, which is the second one down, if you need to get back early. Okay. So 2 weeks from today, the team projects will be giving their final presentation. So it's sort of like the home stretch. So, you know, keep that in mind. Some of the projects may require a lot of effort in these next 2 weeks. Be sure to pace yourself and evaluate where you are in your project and where you want to be. And certainly think about contingency plans. You know, what if you don't get this part made? You know, what if thing that you fabricate, you know, doesn't work as you want it to? So always have a fallback plan. What I really like to have is for the presentation day is something that's functional at whatever level you can make it and test it. So it'd be good for you to have that functionality with your project and certainly bring the prototype here to show to everybody. So the remaining classes, we mentioned the two tours and the last lecture will be March 8th, a week from Thursday. Ralph Hotchkiss is going to be giving his famous talk on wheelchair fabrication in developing countries. It's a very interesting talk. I would suggest that you attend that. Then the following Tuesday, the final presentations. And the Thursday of that week, course evaluation and end-of-term celebration. So this is a chance for everybody to let loose. We're going to have some pizza and burritos next door, and that ought to be a lot of fun. I want to make this announcement. Susan Krieger has this class, Seminar in Women's Health, Women and Disabilities. This course explores visible and invisible disabilities, women's psychological as well as physical health, cross-cultural variables, and disabled women's identities and diversity of experiences. Disabilities covered will include blindness, multiple sclerosis, diabetes, arthritis, emotional and learning disabilities, and conditions requiring wheelchairs and other forms of physical assistance. So it's in feminine studies, and it's a spring quarter course. So it's a seminar course, so keep that in mind. So on Thursday, like I said, we'll be going to the Nicole.
Accounts and citizenship and education.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for that information. Little Garage is very close to the motion and gait analysis lab, so it's not a long trip. You can probably bike there if you can. It's probably about 3 miles, perhaps. Henry Evans will be there. He's a fellow with quadriplegia from Los Altos, and a PR2 will be showing us around. That's what they said, at least. And if you're going to Will Garage, just sort of to orient yourself, here we are at Stanford. Here's Will Garage, just inches away on the map. So as you zoom in, you can go across University and go down one of these streets that are parallel to University to Middlefield Road, and make a left turn on Will Road, and it will be on the left. And you can park along here or in the back, and the entrance is right here. So we'll all meet in the lobby as close to 4:30 as we can. Okay. And here you can see the skylight. It's a very nice building. And then on Tuesday, March 6th, these are the people that we're going to be seeing. Dr. Graham Creasy, who's the chief of spinal cord injury at the VA, and a bunch of therapists who are involved in the assistive technology center there. So that ought to be a pretty good time. And here's how to get to the VA. So just take a campus drive out to Unipercero Boulevard and cross Page Mill, make a left turn on Hillview, and then an immediate right turn onto Miranda, and make a left turn at the flagpole, and park over here, and we're going to be meeting in Building 7 at this corner building, corner room on the building there. Speaking about corners, I want to talk about corner reflector. A corner reflector is a retro reflector consisting of mutually perpendicular intersecting flat surfaces which reflect waves back directly toward the source. So a mirror is a reflective source, but you know, you don't see the reflection of a light on it unless you're, you know, perpendicular to it. But if you have two mirrors that are right angles to each other, any incident wave gets bounced back right to you. And if you have three intersecting corner reflector, then any light beam gets reflected right back to you. And so this can be made physically out of mirrors, and they've actually made a tape out of it as well. So you can apply this tape, and you've seen it on vests of construction workers and people like that. And they can also make it into these balls, which are markers that are used in the motion and gait lab. And if you take a picture of it, a photo of it using a flash, this is what you get. And you can see how great a reflector it is. So that's what's meant by retroreflective. Very neat stuff. So today we're going to have Terry Adams talk about her topic of the year. But before that, I'd like to bring up Mia Davis. She had an eye problem and was unable to do her midterm presentation until today. So let's welcome Mia up to the front. And anybody who doesn't have a evaluation sheet, please come up and get it. I'll mic her up and turn on your PowerPoint.
Okay, cool.
Okay, you're on.
Okay, hi, I'm Mia Davis, and my project is custom mobility, making the wheelchair personal, so adding customization so that you can personalize your wheelchair. Some statistics are that 1.6 million Americans residing outside of institutions use wheelchairs, and that only 10% of these individuals use electric wheelchairs. And about 600,000 are working age adults, 900,000 are the elderly, so above age 65, and fewer than 88,000 are under the age of 18. Also, women make up about 60% of wheelchair users. So for my project, as of right now, women were my target group just because that's the most. And also, I found that women are more interested in customizing than men. Also, wheelchair users are among the most visible members of the disability community, because obviously you can look at a wheelchair and see it and know that someone has a disability. And therefore, a lot of times wheelchairs are just equated with a disability, and even the sign, the universal handicap sign, is an individual in a wheelchair. So the goal of my project was to redefine the perception of wheelchairs and wheelchair users, and to create a feasible and practical but attractive design, and to ensure affordability, because a lot of times it's an issue of, do I want to buy something to add on to my wheelchair if it serves no functional purpose and it's just for aesthetics? So anyway, the first wheelchair was built in 1933, and you can see it in this image right there. That's an advertisement. There haven't been many improvements to the chair since. Most of them are functional, which is great, but there haven't been many aesthetic improvements. And Confucius, there's depictions of him dating back to 6th century ancient China. And I thought that his chair looked a lot cooler than the chairs that we see today. And so how can we get to that? So these are the three most common wheelchairs that are covered by insurance and Medicare. There's the veranda, and a description on the website said it has the look and feel of a more expensive chair with an unbeatable price. I guess I personally didn't think it looked necessarily more expensive than either of these two, which are the Breezy and the Tracer, which are the other two most common ones. So, but these were the chairs I focused on for the project, were manual wheelchairs. So we live in an age of customization. You can customize anything from your phone to a blender, I found. And so why not customize something, a device that people use to get around, essentially an extension of themselves, because they use it so often and for everything. And the options, I found these online. They're really expensive, and I thought they were very ostentatious, a little bit impractical. This one, too, I thought this was over the top. And also, another problem with this is that it's built on. You have to build it this way, so you can't change it once you buy it like this. You'd have to always have this version. This is another website, and I thought this was a better approach, but yeah. So these were some chairs I saw, just three. There's a lot of chairs I saw, but these were three that stood out to me. I liked the one. I thought they looked good. And these are just commonly known as well-designed chairs. And these were wheelchairs I found online. None of them work. They're not functional. But just that look interesting and cool. And so I asked people about these and their thoughts. Some people thought the two top ones, they're for car lovers, is what the website said, that they looked a little bit too much, but then another person said that they would be impressed if someone had them. I really liked the one on the bottom just because I think it looks comfortable. And so anyway, these are also commonly known chairs, not the top one. But, and the thing I thought that they have in common are that they look comfortable. So many of the people I spoke with, their main concern with wheelchairs, and the reason that they thought that wheelchair users looked, a lot of people described it as old, or just like that wheelchairs are unattractive, is because they don't look very comfortable. So I was thinking about ways to add cushions to make them more comfortable and aesthetically appealing. So something more like this, where it's there's more dimension to it than just the flat surfaces. So this is something I came up with, which would be just a canvas surrounding a padding, so like a cushion. You could remove it easily. It would just zip down, and you can put it in the wash and everything like that. And then it would just have a padding on the back and then as well as on the seat. In terms of attaching it to the wheelchair, I was thinking originally that you could do buttons just on the back, fasten them, and then on the back of the chair have four buttons in the same place to attach it easily, and then you could remove it pretty easily. But then I was thinking that the chairs themselves would have to come with the buttons on them, because otherwise, and that's impractical for an industrial level thing. So then I was thinking about Velcro and having, you could peel just a sheet of Velcro and peel it. It would be sticky on one side. Peel it to the back of the chair, and then the back of your new attachment would also have Velcro, so then it would just stick on there and that way. It could be in different patterns, materials for different occasions, a variety of things, whatever you want to change them out. Mainly, I think a good thing is that it adds comfort. And I know I was talking to an individual that I interviewed is Aubrey Lee, who's up there, and she said that when she uses a manual wheelchair that it's not very comfortable. So adding comfort, I think, is a huge component. And even Barbie has a cute wheelchair. So on this website to buy a wheelchair, it said customize and buy. So I was like, oh, customizations. But the options are like a cup holder. There's this poncho and then this armrest, which I didn't think these looked very attractive. And there weren't very many options. There's not really that many options to customize. So these are side attachments that exist. The one on the bottom, I think, looks very bulky, and the one on the top doesn't really fit very much. And then they have backpacks, but they're not very accessible. This one is really not accessible. And then that one is a side, but you can't see what you're getting, so that's not very helpful. This is Aubrey. Thanks for letting me take this picture. She has her purse around the front, and so and she said when she has to use a manual wheelchair that she has to carry her purse in her lap, and that's not very comfortable. So these are just some things I saw, cute designs. Using magnets or zippers and putting it on the side, I think, is a space that you already have, and utilizing that space to actually have something practical. Because I think for at least a lot of women, a main staple of their personality is seen in their purse. Most women wear a purse, and it's an automatic sign of their personality. So this is something easily that you could attach to the side. Again, I thought with the Velcro idea, just have it on the side. It would be elastic so that it could fit a lot in it. Different designs. You could get a lot of different purse companies, I think, involved with this. And it could be a magnetic clasp, a zipper, a button, really anything. Lastly, I thought about the tires, and so I think these are a little much, but they could be nice in terms of visibility. Seeing the wheelchair user at night with the wheels would be helpful, but I'm still thinking about ways to make add lights without this being this crazy, although some people I think would probably like this. So inspiration from, this is David Pompa design, just colored wheels. I think that they add a nice style without being too much, and they're also relatively inexpensive. They're only $30, I found, for a pair on one website, so that's a really nice idea. It's simple to add and adds a nice element of style. So future work is building a functional prototype, get feedback from users, think about improvements for electric wheelchairs, and brainstorm more options for men. Keeping in mind affordability, compactness, which is the thing I was thinking about. If it had the padding, how could you fold it up when you're traveling with it? So those are other factors to consider. If anyone has any questions.
So what are you going to be prototyping? What exactly are we going to be seeing in 2 weeks?
What I want to prototype is just something, the actual physical thing to attach to the back and to the seat. I was thinking, I didn't want to go down the purse alley, I might, but I think that that's pretty simple. Yeah. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
If they're regular users.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We're having a break here. You can come up and sign in and sign up for your carpool for your tours. And Terry, if you can make your way down when you're ready. The tours are our first things. So this is for World Garage and Thursday, and this is for.
No cookies for me, thank you.
Okay, Terry Adams is the Assistant Director of the Office of Accessible Education and the Student Disability Resource Center here at Stanford. The center is committed to providing Stanford students with disabilities.
Excuse me.
Support and services needed to allow them the opportunity to participate in a rich and varied life at Stanford. In addition to academic accommodations for students, Terry also expedites all housing assignments and facility requests related to disability. And I think I've had her every year in the class, and every year she talks about a different topic, and I just love the diversity of her topics, and she's always very articulate. So, Terry,
it says mute.
Don't press that then.
All right, I won't. Well, no pressure.
Let's welcome Terry.
So, you get no extra points for suffering is something I often tell my students when they acquire a disability or they've been really sick or they've acquired a chronic illness. And they are referred to my office by perhaps academic advising or Vaden. And I would say 95% of the time, I think it's partly because they're Stanford students and they're extremely type A for the most part. They want the minimum accommodation possible. And while that can be admirable, it pretty much guarantees if they're still ill or still recovering from, you know, a break in their leg or their arm or whatever, a fair amount of hardship on their part. And I think it's partly, you know, when you're in your late teens or early 20s, it's kind of hard to imagine that 10 years from now, nobody is going to care if you only took 8 units in a quarter. They're not going to care if you have a W on your transcript. And they're really not going to care if you stop out for a quarter. But telling that to an undergrad especially, they just don't believe me. But beyond the youth factor, I think that there is still a tremendous reluctance to show weakness, or what is perceived as weakness, when people acquire disabilities. And, you know, I'll say to someone in that situation, maybe who has developed a difficulty with mobility, well, use a wheelchair part of the time to conserve your energy. No, no, I have to keep walking. Use a power chair some of the time instead of a manual chair all of the time. No, no, I can do it. And at the end of the day, yes, maybe you can, but you're exhausted. And I can speak from personal experience, if you have any kind of discomfort, chronic pain associated with mobility, it takes way more energy to drag your ass around if it hurts. It just does. And I couldn't do my job if I was trying to walk, because I get blisters on my feet from walking. And by the end of the day, I would just be wiped out. And that would be even if I was just walking around our office. And imagine going around campus. It wouldn't be feasible. So I just try to get students, and more broadly, people with acquired disabilities. Sometimes it's people who are aging and they're developing disabilities that are related to aging. Easier is not necessarily a bad thing, and comfort is not necessarily being a wuss, you know. You might end up being able to do a lot more things a lot more often if you take it easy. So that's where the title of my talk comes from. I'm hoping that you guys will ask me questions related to any aspect of disability, because I find that when I talk to, whether it's students or staff or faculty, there are people that have questions about disability that they're afraid to ask because they don't think it's politically correct, or because they think it's too personal. And it really helps, it helps everybody if you just ask the questions. So nothing is off limits. And if you think of something while I'm talking, go ahead and just, you know, interrupt me. It's totally fine. I'm going to use my own disability as kind of a case study, because it's the one I know best, and I'm not blowing anybody else's confidentiality. And because I'm 54, it gives you a look at how a lot of things have changed in the last 50 years, and how a lot of things have not changed in the last 50 years. But one thing I wanted to mention that I just found out on Facebook yesterday is that tomorrow, February 29th, is Rare Diseases Day. And I think it's in Europe primarily, but I think it's cool that it's on the 29th of February. But I looked at a video, and they said, and I can't remember now, being 54, that's the way it goes, whether they said that a rare disease was 1 in 2,000 or 1 in 5,000. My disability is 1 in 200,000 people are born with my disability. So I'm extra rare, extra special. My disability is a genetic mutation that causes the body to produce skin too fast, and then the skin that is produced doesn't break down properly. So I get flaking and callousing and blisters instead of skin coming off. And, you know, basically, unless you have a sunburn, your skin is coming off all the time, but you're just not particularly aware of it. My doctor told me last year that I turn over the amount of skin in a week that most people do in a month. So no wonder I'm so tired all the time. And it's a spontaneous mutation, so I did not inherit it from either side with my parents. And so they were, you know, 1957, it was a big shocker. I don't think it was accurately diagnosed till I was probably 8 or 9. And then I didn't get a specific diagnosis. My condition is called epidermolytic hyperkeratosis, and I don't think they narrowed it down to that until I was in my 20s. There aren't any treatments because they have identified the gene that's broken, but it's broken, it's not missing, so gene therapy is not there yet. There are types of ichthyosis, other skin conditions, where there's a missing gene, and there has been some success with gene therapy for those types of disorders. So I was born in 57, went to see a million dermatologists. Nobody really had a clue what to do. I started school when I was, I'm born in October, so I started school when I was not quite 6, my local school, and the teacher I had freaked out, lied to the other kids and told them I had a bad sunburn, and I could already read because I wasn't out running around a lot. So the real reason for me to be in kindergarten was for socialization, and since the teacher lied and told the kids something, they kids are not stupid. They knew I didn't have a sunburn. So nobody would play with me, so I wasn't getting socialization. And long story short, I ended up in special education in San Mateo County. And at that time, kids with what would be called severe physical disabilities were all segregated into this one school. So I was there from the age of 6 until 13 when I was bused to I lived in San Mateo, I was bused to a high school in San Bruno because there still was not mandated mainstreaming at that time in 72. Well, I started high school in 71. So that was my early school experience. Special education was very poor instructionally. I was lucky that I was pretty smart and also that my parents were elementary school teachers. So by the time I got to high school, I was able to compete with my classmates that had regular public school education. But I was really worried about it until I started and found that I could keep up. A lot of kids that might have learning disabilities or other types of disabilities who also were bused to high school at that point had a much harder time. So juxtapose that. So that was the 60s and the early 70s. Today, if I started elementary school, I would be mainstreamed. And they would make a assessment to see if I needed any kind of special services based on the nature of my disability. I probably would have gotten things like being exempted from PE or being sent to an adaptive PE program of some type. Probably would have a mobility assistance. And the school, if it wasn't already accessible, and today I think most in this area, I'm not talking about the middle of the country where you could still end up being segregated if your parents didn't fight for you. And interestingly, if I was born today, they still wouldn't have an effective treatment. So some things are different and some things are the same. The hardest part of my disability, I would say, from this age looking back, has been social and economic. It is getting much better now because there's more people with all types of disabilities in the community, and so people are accustomed to seeing wheelchairs and accustomed to seeing people look a little bit different. But when I was a kid, you would never see a wheelchair out in public, and you would never see people with obvious disabilities. Very rarely you would see maybe a blind person, a person with a guide dog, but not, you know, not walking around downtown. You didn't see it. And so the fact that we're all getting out there more is making it easier for people to become acclimated to people that look different. And so that's a huge plus too. The downside, or the side that's slower to evolve, I would say, is some employers are still hesitant to hire someone with a visible disability. And if they want to not hire you, they can find a way that will get them under the radar legally. It's not, you know, it's not a slam dunk if you feel that you didn't get the job and it was because of your disability. Proving that is very difficult unless you have somebody saying wildly inappropriate things to you in front of witnesses. It would be very hard. So the jobs I've had, I had one job at Visa, the credit card company, and the reason I got hired for that job, I think, is that the lady that hired me, her husband had a skin condition. And so the fact that I had a skin condition didn't automatically make her think that, oh no, you know, she won't be able to do the job, or she'll be sick all the time, or whatever it is, whatever tapes are running in people's heads. She just thought it kind of made me more interesting. And so that was a long-term job I had. And the jobs I've had since I went to law school, which I did in my early 30s, have all been disability-related. And that is not an accident. That is the community that was ready to accept me and saw my disability as a plus, not a minus. So I consider that to some extent I'm typecast. I mean, I do have a lot of skills in this area, but I also worked in banking for almost 10 years, and I do have other skills that are transferable, but I think it would be very difficult for me to switch because of my disability, even today. The point of this class, the assistive technology, is huge, and I think it will be bigger and bigger in the next 10 or 15 years because of the aging boomers. So whatever you design that makes people's day-to-day life a little bit easier. I was talking to Aubrey. She remembers vividly, and I don't remember when I told you about the tongs. There are reachers, there are grabbers for people in chairs or people that are confined to bed. It has kind of a pistol grip, and then it's long, and then it's got like two points of contact, and you are supposed to be able to grip it and pick things up or get cans down, God help you, from the cabinet without smacking your brains out. And I can't use those because it takes too firm a grip. And so I use salad tongs, cooking tongs. And I was telling Aubrey I have them everywhere. I have them in my bedroom. I have them in the kitchen. I have some in my glove compartment for when I lose napkins down on the floor, and that's an example of a tool that is designed for a completely different purpose, but it serves me and my disability particularly well. And it's affordable, you know, $6-7, and you've got a tool that's not going to break unless you do something radical with it. And as far as we've come with disabilities and disability services, getting someone to pay for an expensive piece of equipment, especially if it's really specialized, is very, very difficult. And even though I have really good health insurance, getting my insurance company to pay for even my wheelchair and keeping my wheelchair maintained has been, you have to be prepared to fight. It took me almost a year to fight to get my last wheelchair replaced. So it's not easy. And if you are not prepared to fight, and a lot of people, especially if they're older, don't have an idea about where even to start to fight with their insurance company. So it's a complex business having a full-time disability. It can be very time-consuming, depending on how long you've been at it and your personality. Because a lot of times the first answer is no, as a matter of course, and because they know that a certain percentage of people are going to give up at that point. And then a lot of times the second answer is no, and then that eliminates another demographic who thought, no, I'm going to fight for this, and then it's just too overwhelming. So there's, I've heard the saying that aging is not for wimps, and having a severe disability is not really for wimps either. You really have to be kind of prepared to advocate for yourself. But it's tricky because sometimes you have really good service providers who are doing their very best for you, and they're still dropping the ball. But you don't want to burn that bridge if you can get the process back on course without upsetting anybody. So it takes diplomacy too. I just spent the weekend with my dad, who turned 87, yesterday. And even if you think, oh, I'll never have a disability, if you live long enough, you will. And if your parents live long enough, they will. And it might be something like diabetes, or the older they get, it will be some kind of cognitive impairment. My dad is still pretty sharp, but I noticed this weekend that as the day went on, he kind of sundowned a little bit, and that's a phrase they use to describe how older people, and particularly people with various types of dementia, kind of literally after the sun goes down, they might have more signs of depression, or they're not following you as well, they're not remembering as well. And I really noticed it this, because I spent about 24 hours with him, and I really noticed it this weekend, the not remembering and not noticing. We were in a hotel he had never been in before, and not noticing landmarks that were very apparent to me. So it's good to think of disability as a spectrum and not be afraid of it. You can have a very full life with a fairly high degree of disability if you get all the right services and if you adjust the way you think about it to be realistic, but maybe a little ambitious. So, does anybody have any questions? Or, yes? Well, I have a couple answers to that. I was actually thinking about this the other day. So I didn't get any mobility aids until I was 33, and that is because the doctors thought it was better that I walk in pain than have a mobility aid, because they don't think in terms of function and comfort. They think that walking, even though I did not look normal by any stretch, that walking is more normal than using a chair. And so when I was about 33, and I was in law school, I had a really good advisor who said, maybe we can get vocational rehab to buy you a scooter. Well, a scooter, and the scooter I got eventually was $2,500. A power chair, like the one I'm sitting in, was $8,500. The scooter is easier to transport because you can take it apart. So it's cheaper, it's more transportable. It breaks down into more manageable pieces than a power chair. But when I got to Stanford, I still had a scooter, and I was told by one of the students in our office that scooters were not cool. No offense, Aubrey. And so, also, scooters can be tippy, and I superficially injure very easily. If I bang myself or I fall, the top layer of skin just comes off. And so I'm extra paranoid about tipping. And so another reason to get a power chair is you have a firmer footprint.
Can you customize the scooter the way you can customize?
I think you can as you go up the price spectrum. For example, you can put a seat on a scooter that goes up and down. There's another mechanism and another motor and another $1,000. Well, maybe $75. I mean, maybe $750. You can have four wheels instead of three. You can have headlights. And then there's a whole range of speeds. The really inexpensive scooters might go 3 miles an hour, and the really robust ones go about eight. Eight is a nice speed. This chair goes eight at its maximum, and it's a very nice speed. So this is just more comfortable for me. But when doctors are prescribing, I'm at a huge advantage because I just tell them what I want. A lot of doctors have no clue about durable medical equipment. So if you don't know, you're at their mercy. And you could end up with a piece of equipment that really isn't suitable. I saw another hand. Oh, hi, Nicole.
Hi.
Hi. Did you have a question?
I'd like to add to something that you said.
Sure.
First, this whole idea of kind of suffering instead of being comfortable, like doing what you've been doing and being in pain, that's not just with wheelchairs, it's with everything. A lot of times when people lose their sight or they start losing their sight, they're told to start reading Braille, and they don't want to. They want to keep reading print as long as they can.
Yeah, I agree.
And something else that Terry said about some things haven't changed, and some things really haven't changed in the school system. Mainstream might be required for mainstream now, but there's still, in some cases, it's still possible for teachers to discriminate against you, and I've had it happen to me. Definitely it only happened once, but it does still happen.
Yeah, I agree. I know that that's true. And actually, now that you mention it, people that lose their hearing, there's also a lot of age-related hearing loss. My mom is a great example. She has had hearing loss, I would say, for at least 30 years, and she will not get a hearing aid. So she misses a lot of conversation, and it's just sort of, what? Most of the time. What did they say? And the other side of the hearing aid thing is that most insurance does not cover hearing aids. So a few years ago, I had transitory hearing loss, and it was right on the edge of needing hearing aids. And because of my experience with my mom, when I went and had my hearing tested, and they said, "Oh, you're right on the edge," I said, "I'm getting hearing aids right now." But it went away. It was the result of a bad cold I'd had, and we waited 6 months, and it came back. So I was lucky. But I never want to be one of the what people. Yeah, there's a lot of things like that, Nicole. You're right. Yes.
Hi. I'm just curious. What would have been your dream job? I guess when you were still in college, if you could have done anything, and you didn't like face that barrier of just having your disability and having a lot of employees not really recognize that you're positive.
That's a really great question. I'll start my answer by telling you that when I was a senior and maybe a junior in high school, I took one of those aptitude tests. And my greatest aptitude was to be a Navy officer. My second one was to be an attorney. And my third one was to be an Army officer. And I do really like both. So who knows? I might have liked the Navy. Although then there would have been the whole gender thing, right? Because that was still the early 70s. I really liked singing, too. And I might have pursued that more. After I went to law school, so that was in my 30s, I hated law school. I hated every minute of it. But I didn't have a plan B, so once I had started, I just kind of finished. I think I would have perhaps liked to teach English or writing at the college level. And it sounds like a cliche because I think particularly with ethnic minorities, people say this, but I can say that it's absolutely true. I had no role models for choices that I might pursue. Nobody that looked like me, no disabled people with various types of disabilities doing various types of jobs. So I literally, when I graduated high school and I started junior college, I thought I might want to teach English at the junior college level. And I certainly could have gotten a degree. I don't know if anybody would have hired me. But I went to junior college and I placed in the highest English class you could take in junior college. And I was surrounded by people who hated English and hated being there. And I thought, if I'm teaching English, this is the kind of class I'm going to have for a long time. I don't want to do that. And so after a couple of years of junior college, that's when I started working at Visa because I couldn't figure out what else to do. Okay. Trying to think of kind of one to a customer type accommodations. Once we paid for an assistant to go on a field trip for a geology class, she needed a personal care assistant and also somebody to help her because it was out in the field. But it was totally academically related, and so we paid for her personal assistant for that field trip. We modify housing to whatever extent is necessary to make a housing assignment work for a student. So one of the most intensely argued accommodations once was to lower a toilet below what the code requires because a student was able to transfer herself from her wheelchair in the bathroom, but it had to be exactly a certain height for her to be able to do that. So I worked with housing facilities to do that. more commonly we do, but people I think are not as familiar with it. Instead of sign language interpreters, some deaf students or some students who have lost some of their hearing who don't know sign language get real-time captioning. And that's someone who has been trained as a court reporter. She or he, mostly she, they use software, and so they're using a keyboard like the ones you'll see in court, but and captioning the class live, and then the caption comes up on a screen, and the student sits with them and gets a caption of the class. Yes? Well, before I came to Stanford in 95, housing had, with the help of some students with disabilities, made a capital improvement plan to make a couple of types of housing more accessible every summer. So, and that has continued to this day. So there's visiting accessible, and then there's living accessible. And visiting accessible means you can get in the dorm, there's a bathroom you can use, and you can get around the main area. Living accessible means that there are rooms that are big enough for a student who uses a chair to be able to get around in their room and use the dining facilities. There's a laundry room that's accessible, etc. And so there are more and more of them. What I've been alerting housing to for the last couple of years is that we have more students using wheelchairs or scooters on campus right now than ever before. And so we haven't run out of space, but if we keep having new frosh, you know, 1 to 3 new frosh that use chairs every fall, we will run out of space in undergrad housing. And so if they have to, they'll adapt something over the summer. Yeah?
When you find out that a student is disabled, is it on their application to Stanford, or they
not
come
necessary.
On campus and then they contact you?
It really runs the gamut. A lot of students who have severe disabilities will contact our office when they're juniors or seniors in high school and visit to see what kind of services are available, how we handle housing, all those types of things. Then if they are accepted, those also typically tend to contact us immediately, especially if they're, in fact, I got a paperwork today, an early admit has already made an appointment to see me in April during pro-fro. Others will contact us over the summer, and some I eventually get a list from admissions of students that have been identified as having a disability, and any that we haven't already heard from, I reach out to, and I would say, let's say that's 30 students. About 15% will write back and say, oh, thank you for contacting me. I need this, that, and the other thing. And we'll, you know, go through the process. About 30% I'll never hear from. And then there's another 30% that will contact me very late in the game. And housing always gets mad at me because I'll say, oh, I just found out about it. And it's, why didn't you tell us before? And it's like, I didn't know. So it's all over the place. Yeah?
I have two questions that are kind of unrelated.
That's
one is,
cool.
In terms of the competitions, I'm given Stanford as a society, what do you think are the greatest advances that community has done in cities or great living areas, what accommodations people need them as far as that can be done, and what do you think hasn't changed that could have easily changed
I'll answer the second question first because it's a shorter answer. My guesstimate is that only about 5% of the requests we get are flat-out bogus. And if we turn those down initially, unfortunately, people can get documentation that will say whatever they want if they're determined to do so. And we're not equipped legally or with staffing to go and investigate every one of those. So if I have a letter from a doctor that by any stretch looks legitimate, even if I think, not so much, they will probably get what the letter says. That being said, if the letter says a student needs a single on the row, it's very unlikely that I'm going to say they have to live on the row. I may say, yes, they need to live in a single. So there is some abuse, but the abuse that I'm aware of is 5% or less. So that's not too bad. And there are a lot of hidden disabilities. And there are a lot of hidden disabilities that, I mean, sometimes you'll have a guess after dealing with a student, especially if they have a psych disability and they may be withdrawn or they may be bipolar and seem very outgoing sometimes and very withdrawn other times. But they may have a chronic illness. And I would say I have as many singles for chronic illness type disabilities as I do for psych disorders. And we take into account, you know, the overall well-being of the student with the disability, but also the house, because somebody with a chronic, maybe a chronic digestive disorder where they have to get up and go to the bathroom maybe 10 times during the night when they're having an exacerbation, that would suck for their roommate too. So we really try to be thoughtful about it. I think in some ways little things like curb cuts are just huge. And those were mandated over 30 years ago. And in some, you know, every city, the degree to which they have good curb cuts varies. I used to live in San Francisco, and if I was downtown, the curb cuts were old and steep and coming apart sometimes. The pavement was, you know, a chunk might be missing. And if you got to south of Market, you'd be on a block where you'd get up on the sidewalk from a curb cut, and you'd get to the end of the block, and there's no curb cut. And that still happens. But, I mean, you'll hear over and over again, curb cuts are good for everybody. People with strollers, people delivering stuff. So those things are really good. Being able to park close to where you want to go with a disabled placard is really good. And going back to your other question, I think there's a lot more scamming with disability placards. And, you know, you can get a placard for your elderly relative that you're supposed to only use when you're driving them around. And people, sometimes they use them when the relative isn't there or even after the relative has passed away and the placard hasn't expired. And you're supposed to send it back, but oops, I forgot. Oops, I was in a hurry. And oops, I took your parking space. So I would say there's more scamming with that sort of thing. I think there hasn't been enough education for employers about the fact, I mean, you'll hear it over and over if you even skim the surface of research, that employment accommodations, the average one is less than $500. But still, employers are afraid it's going to cost them a ton of money to hire someone with a disability. For me, the minimum I need is an accessible restroom, I need to be able to get in the building, and I need to be able to use my office furniture. I have an extra at Stanford. It's not required by law, but I have a power door on my office so that I can push a button and open the door, and also I can lock it from the inside and leave, and then when I come back, I can just push the button instead of having to use a key. That's really huge for me. And that's the most costly accommodation I have, and that's probably, initially installing that was $5,000, but there's no ongoing cost for that. And an employer as big as Stanford couldn't say they can't afford that. So, I think it's education, and I think it's education of employers, and I think it's people thinking outside the box. And that's going to take another 50 years, I think. I've often thought that in terms of civil rights and ending segregation, people with disabilities are kind of where African Americans were in the 60s. We're still in the 60s. We still have a long way to go.
Terry, I'd like to thank you again for your thoughtful presentation. It's always delightful to have you, and it's nice to know that you're by.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for coming, Nicole.
Yeah, I have to see Yano soon, but I have to tell you a really funny story.
Okay.
When I graduated from high school, my dad and I took a trip to the East Coast to see some of his relatives.
Uh-huh.
And I had one of those talking glasses. And one night, we came back to the hotel, and of all things, the hotel solo band was parked in the handicapped parking spot.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, my dad's curious, but he can be a bit curious than he wants to be.
Uh-huh.
We walk in, we walk up to the receptionist, and we say, "Does your son have a disability?" And so he's kind of scared, and I'm like,
That's great. Yeah, well, I got some cops in trouble one time.
Oh, no.
When I lived in San Francisco, there was a disabled parking space right in front of Starbucks. And so that was, of course, my premium location, because that was before I had a wheelchair. And I was with some friends, and we got there, and there was a cop car parked in that space. So one of the people in my group worked for the mayor's office on disability at the time. And those people got suspended without pay for 3 days.
So I'm not shot red-handed.
Yes, yes. So.
All right. Well, I gotta go.
Okay. Have a good day. Do you have a?
Hello.